Lecture 5, Nineveh and Its Remains.
And now we come to a remarkable figure in a history of discovery of civilization peopled by remarkable figures, a young archaeologist, Austin Henry Layard, one of the most remarkable personalities of the 19th century. In this lecture, we follow Layard's horseback journey from England to the desert city of Petra in present-day Jordan, then follow his adventures along the Tigris River and among the Bakhtiari nomads of Iran. From there, we follow his obsession with the huge city mounds of Mesopotamia, where he digs into ancient Nimrud and Koyunjik, discovers Assyrian civilization, and identifies biblical Nineveh. Incredible although it may seem, Austin Henry Layard did almost all of these things virtually single-handed. The search for early civilization in Mesopotamia was driven by a 19th century passion for biblical history. It was a devout age, an age where theological dogma taught that the Old Testament was the literal historical truth. Nineveh was known from the scriptures as the Assyrian capital, an Assyrian capital destroyed by the Persians in 614 BC. But where was Nineveh? What was it like? Could anything be discovered of the nature of this extraordinary settlement? As we saw in the previous lecture, English diplomat Claudius James Rich was the first person to really study Nineveh in the field. But he didn't excavate. He just examined the dusty mounds opposite the small town of Mosul by the Tigris in northern Iraq and recorded desolation. To the devout, the dusty mounds opposite Mosul were a symbol of divine vengeance. In an era when the scriptures were considered historical truth, archaeology was considered a very, very powerful weapon for validating the scriptures. As we also saw last time, the French consul, Paul Emil Botha, specially appointed to Mosul to try and find Nineveh, actually dug into Koyunjik and found nothing. He dug too shallow, but he then transferred his operations to Khorsabad upstream and found the palace we know now of the Assyrian king Sargon. But he claimed it was Nineveh. But, in fact, as we shall see, the true site of biblical Nineveh came to light through the excavations of an adventurous Englishman, Austin Henry Layard. Layard's life spanned the 19th century. He was born in 1817, just after the Napoleonic Wars, and died in 1895, at the very end of the Victorian era. He was a restless young man, articled to a solicitor in London, the idea being that he would become a lawyer. But the young Layard, whose parents lived abroad, was intoxicated by travel and became very restless in the dusty offices of London lawyers. By chance, he met another young man, Charles Mitford, who was going to travel to Ceylon, now Sri Lanka, to start a law practice in the colonies. Unfortunately for history and for archaeology, this gentleman could not travel by sea because he became chronically seasick. So he decided to travel to India overland. This was no mean undertaking, because much of the territory east of Constantinople was untamed and peopled by very volatile desert nomads. Mitford took a liking to Layard and agreed that he could ride with him to India. This was a momentous change in Layard's life. Incredible although it may seem, he had never been on a horse before. So the first thing he had to do was to learn how to ride a horse. He did it the hard way. They travelled east, living on literally nothing. Eventually, they came to the city of Jerusalem. And here, Layard became increasingly fascinated by desert life. He went off by himself while Mitford remained in Jerusalem and travelled through the desert to the mysterious rock-cut city of Petra, an ancient caravan city in what is now Jordan, truly one of the most spectacular archaeological sites to visit in the world. At the time, Petra was the home of fierce Bedouin tribesmen who promptly captured Layard, robbed him of all his possessions, and eventually set him free. He returned to Jerusalem, captivated not only by the desert and desert people, but by archaeology. From Jerusalem, the two men travelled across the Syrian desert to the Euphrates and then to the Tigris. This was a comparatively routine journey, provided you paid off the headmen among the nomadic tribes who policed the route. They came to Mosul, where Layard met Botha for the first time. And for the first time also, he saw the dusty mounds across the river, and some other ones down at Nimrud, 30 miles downstream. Layard became obsessed with these mysterious mounds. What story would they tell? What lay within their depths? He talked to Botha, who was already digging at Khorsabad, and was fascinated by the prospect of finding ancient civilizations. They travelled downstream to Baghdad, where Mitford and Layard stayed with the British resident, who was now a Colonel Taylor, who was an Oriental scholar of great distinction. And here, Layard saw his first clay cuneiform tablets. His interest in archaeology was again reinforced, and by this time he was fluent in Arabic and soon learned Persian. They travelled further east, and when they got into Iran, Layard encountered nomadic people for the first time. He was fascinated. But here the two men parted because Mitford just wanted to press on to India. He was tired of travelling, whereas Layard was totally intoxicated by the Bakhtiari nomads. He spent an extraordinary year wandering with them. He was adopted by a tribe after he cured a chief's daughter of sickness. And from there, he returned in fear of his life, because the Turkish authorities were chasing him, back to Baghdad. And from there, he went to Constantinople to become an unpaid attaché of the British ambassador in Constantinople. When I say unpaid attaché, actually he was a discreet secret agent who spent much of his time sort of looking at the politics of nomadic tribes and frontiers, and immersing himself in the culture of the desert. But he never forgot archaeology and his obsession with the mysterious mounds by the Tigris. And eventually, in 1846, he persuaded the British ambassador, Sir Stratford Canning, to finance an excavation at Nimrud, south of Mosul. He arrived in 1846, slipped quietly downstream, and arrived at Nimrud with ideas of palaces and ancient civilizations swimming in his head. He had noticed Botha's excavations at Koyunjik and determined to use a quite different technique. Instead of digging from the surface, he tunneled. He tunneled into the very depths of the mounds, looking for stone walls and then following them, arguing that these walls were in fact the rooms of the palaces which might lie underneath these huge dusty mounds. Incredible although it may seem, he found two Assyrian palaces at Nimrud in a month, the first in a few days. Now, when I say he found a palace, what he found more specifically was a vast structure full of rooms, most of them lined with magnificent bas-reliefs, bas-reliefs which depicted kings at war, campaigns in foreign lands, sieges, hunts, slaves building mounds, and all kinds of different activities, even leather boats floating on the Tigris. He also found pairs of huge human-headed lions which guarded the gates of the palaces of Nimrud. But he could not identify who the kings were or who had built these palaces, because he could not decipher cuneiform. This was an extraordinary excavation. Layard worked with hundreds of labourers. He lived like a king among them, mediating disputes, even marrying off women, and in constant fear that somebody would raid his camp. He found the only way to handle the situation was to live like a desert sheikh himself, to act resolutely, and to try and be a king among his men. And he succeeded brilliantly. He had a sort of charisma, a presence, a liveliness, which is a characteristic of young leaders of that era. And his discoveries were extraordinary. Using these hundreds of men, he tunneled deep into the Nimrud mounds, uncovering yards and yards of bas-reliefs. He would draw and copy them. Then he would remove them from the wall, haul them on rollers out of the tunnel. Then, using carts made of simple materials, he would roll them to the river and load them on rafts, ready for the journey down to the Persian Gulf. It sounds fairly straightforward, but you have to realize he was working in basically a treeless environment. His only materials were what he could find, and his only asset was dozens of strong-armed people. So he had to lever and use ropes and improvise. And one of the skills of the great discoverers of the civilizations was their ability, like Belzoni, to improvise. For example, he actually lowered two human-headed lions onto carts and hauled them on down to the river. These weighed hundreds of tons each. What was even more interesting was the way that he shipped the stuff down. It was a simple system, one that is so staggeringly system and almost takes your breath away. He would hire rafts. Now, these rafts consisted of wooden platforms supported by dozens of inflated goat skins. He would load the loads onto these rafts. The rafts would then float down the Tigris in constant danger of raids from marauding brigands, who on occasion, as we'll see, attacked the rafts. They would then arrive at Basra. The material would be offloaded to await a ship to go to London. Then, with the classic ingenuity, the raft captain would sell the wood, which was in high demand down in the south, simply deflate the goatskins, load them on donkeys, and carry it all upstream and do the whole process over again. What was even more fascinating was that Layard found bas-reliefs showing identical watercraft being used by the Assyrians. The technology survived into this century. Just the logistics of all this make you tired to look at, because he was almost alone. His discoveries caused a sensation in London. And as the first shipments began to arrive at the British Museum in London, and you can see them there to this day, he started work at Koyunjik. Here, again, unlike Botha, he tunneled, and immediately he found more palaces. The discoveries were spectacular. In 1848, he returned to London and found himself a popular hero. You see, what you have to remember is that what he had done was to actually find spectacular palaces in a desolate landscape. I mean, he wrote of the landscape. Desolation meets desolation. A feeling of awe succeeds to wonder, for there is nothing to relieve the mind, to head to hope, or to tell of what has gone by. Fame of his excavations had preceded him. A British journalist, J.J.A. Longworth, of the London Morning Post, went all the way out there to visit Layard. Then, as now, journalists were constantly looking for stories, and he described how he descended into a long tunnel in the twilight between two great lions, the tunnels crowded with busy workers. The figures of bearded kings and viziers appeared like ghosts in the gloom. They might, he wrote, almost be imagined to be stepping down from the walls to question the rude intruder who was disturbing their privacy. Layard came back to London and announced he had found Nineveh. By this time, his finds were in the British Museum. And ladies and gentlemen, if ever you go to the British Museum, please, I beg you, make a point of going down to the basement and looking at the Assyrian bas-reliefs. They are truly magnificent. And the lovely thing about them is you can get close and look at the intricate, sure carving done by the artisans who worked for the king. This is wonderful stuff. And you realize almost all of it was found by one man. He also wrote a book. And one of the great joys of 19th century archaeology was that many of the archaeologists who made these staggering discoveries, unlike many archaeologists today, could really write. And Austin Henry Layard wrote a book called Nineveh and Its Remains, in which he described Assyrian civilization for the first time. Hitherto, they were shadowy people known only from passing references in the Old Testament's second book of Kings. The book was an immediate bestseller. It is a vivid account not only of excavations, but of life among the people, of a volatile society where prestige meant everything. And it's a wonderful, almost unwitting account of how he coped with challenges far larger than you might expect a man in his 20s to have to cope with, because Layard was still under 30. His book appeared to immediate popular acclaim. The British Museum had the finds, but they seemed disinterested in any more excavations. Layard resumed his diplomatic career and returned to Constantinople in 1849. But public outcry, the public wanted more, soon ensured that he was detached once again, this time with British Museum support, to carry out more excavations at Mosul and to confirm even further that Kuyunjik was Nineveh. Until now, he had claimed that Nimrud was Nineveh. Like Botha, he'd claimed he'd found it. He didn't really know. But this time, there was a difference. He excavated again at Kuyunjik because he had a suspicion this was the most important site, and really there was more to find here. And at this point, as he began excavations, the British resident in Baghdad, by now a singularly talented gentleman whom we will come across in the next lecture, Henry Creswick Rawlinson, succeeded in deciphering cuneiform inscriptions at both Nimrud and Kuyunjik. And for the first time, Layard learnt that Kuyunjik was Nineveh and that Nimrud was another biblical city, Kala. This was a sensational find. And it made the excavations much more meaningful, because for the first time you could begin to puzzle out who these people were, who owned the palace, some of the campaigns and deeds of the kings, because like modern-day Iraqi rulers, Assyrians boasted grandiloquently of their achievements. The results he now obtained from very big excavations at Koyunjik were truly dramatic. He was unearthed, for example, the entrance to the palace of the great king Sennacherib, who reigned from 704 to 681 BC. Not only that, but he also unearthed a bas-relief of a city known as Lachish in what is now Israel, a siege mentioned in the scriptures. This was seized on by many people as dramatic evidence for the historical veracity of the scriptures. This was a dramatic excavation which people followed on a day-by-day basis in the London Times and elsewhere. And, of course, Layard himself waxed lyrical about his discoveries. He had a wonderful fluency of style, which to this day really makes your skin curl. The tunnels led into the heart of Sennacherib's palace, guarded by two human-headed lions and huge human figures which had been damaged by a fire that collapsed the wooden gate that once closed off the palace from the outside world. Between them was a roadway still rutted by the wheels of war chariots. And of this, Layard wrote, "Between them, Sennacherib and his hosts had gone forth in all their might and glory to the conquest of distant lands, and had returned rich with spoil and captives. Through them, too, the Assyrian monarch had entered his capital in shame after his last and fatal defeat." History coming alive, the Bible coming alive, the Assyrians coming alive. A dramatic, dramatic chronicle of hitherto unknown history. This was what the discovery of ancient civilizations was all about, validating the scriptures and peopling a blank canvas of history with people and monarchs and military campaigns, some of which were in the scriptures. Small wonder that this flamboyant, hard-working young man became a national hero. But his most remarkable discovery of all, and the one with the most long-lasting significance, came at the very end of the Koyunjik excavations. Just as he was beginning to close up the excavations, he came across a chamber filled with piles of cuneiform-inscribed clay tablets. These had once lain on shelves which had collapsed. Layard, as always, and he was working alone, or virtually alone, was in a hurry. So he simply shoveled thousands of cuneiform tablets into local baskets, shoved them in a crate, and shipped them off to London. This turned out to be the royal library and archives of the Assyrian king Ashurbanipal. This library from the 7th century BC turned out to be an extraordinary chronicle, not only of Mesopotamian history, but of legend. And it was this archive that also revealed the presence of much earlier civilizations at Babylon and south in a land called Sumer. And, as we will see in the next lecture, it also led to a remarkable discovery which suggested a connection between biblical literature and the legends of the Mesopotamians. But generations were to pass. This was all in the future, because only about three people in the world had even begun to decipher cuneiform, whose story we will tell in the next talk. So Layard really just, tablets, just put them in some baskets and shipped them off. They were still working on these 75 years later. They still are. He himself, and I think all of these guys, got a little bit sort of captivated by the thought of personal fame and glory, decided it was time he looked down in southern Mesopotamia. By this time, he was tired. He had been working in a country where he constantly got fever, And the stress of dealing with so many people all by himself and being alone really must have begun to get to him. But he went down to the south to have a look at Babylon. But the dusty mounds of Babylon simply looked at Austin Henry Layard, and you can imagine that they smiled and they said, "You're too crude. He tried tunneling, but his tunnels collapsed. He tunneled in and found nothing, because unlike the Assyrian palaces, these were not built of stone. They were built of unfired mud brick, which melted away. And Layard's techniques were simply too crude to really enable him to discover palaces or anything worth having." He dug also into the site of Nippur, and the same thing happened. He couldn't find anything. His methods were too crude. He was defeated by the climate, he was exhausted, and he simply left empty-handed. The techniques for really excavating cities in southern Mesopotamia effectively were not really mastered until the Germans came along with new methods in the early 20th century. Austin Henry Layard returned to England in late 1851. By that time, he had excavated, by his own estimate, over 2 miles of bas-reliefs at Nineveh alone. He recorded his inventory. "I have opened, by a rough calculation, about 9,880 feet, or nearly 2 miles of bas-reliefs, with 27 portals formed by colossal winged bulls and lion sphinxes." He was a legend in his own time. He sat down and wrote a second bestseller, Discoveries in the Ruins of Nineveh and Babylon, which appeared in 1853, again to widespread popular acclaim. But this was a more reasoned book. In it, he wrote the first coherent history of the Assyrians, using inscriptions and tablets deciphered by a parson, Edward Hinks, Henry Rawlinson, whose works described in the next lecture, and others. It was his final word on the Assyrians. He had achieved staggering discoveries without any formal archaeological training whatsoever. He had learnt excavation as he went along, using methods that, to put it mildly, were rough and ready by today's standards, working almost alone. Much of more delicate things he found have been lost and never recorded. But this remarkable adventurer had the great archaeologist's instinct for the vital rather than the trivial, and his prodigious energy made up for many of his shortcomings. He was a man of volatile interests who soon tired of archaeology, and he gave it up in his 30s, at the age of 35. He became, successively, a member of Parliament, had a short career and unsuccessful one as a politician, then became an important diplomat and an internationally known art collector. But his greatest achievement was the excavation of biblical Nineveh, and he put the discovery of Mesopotamian civilization on a new footing. We've devoted the whole of this lecture to Austin Henry Layard and described his inadequate and crude excavation methods while acclaiming his remarkable discoveries. We've described his excavations at Nimrud and Nineveh, culminating in the finding of the royal library of King Ashurbanipal. These finds of his were an important element in the next story, which we'll cover in the following lecture, which is the story of the decipherment of that fiendishly difficult script, cuneiform, which was the work, unlike that of Champollion, of 3 people working in close tandem, the most flamboyant of whom was a cavalryman turned linguist, Henry Creswick Rawlinson. This, like the decipherment of cuneiform, was a turning point in the discovery of ancient civilization. But, like Belzoni, Layard's achievement dwarfs many other finds. And, like Giovanni Belzoni, I beg you to go to the British Museum, go down to the Assyrian basement, and look around. Because, as I said with Belzoni, and I will say again with Layard, if you seek his monument, Look around you, for on the walls of the Assyrian basement at the British Museum are the bas-reliefs he found that made archaeological history.